From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Laura Weber Davis, in for April Baer. Today on the show, Republicans in the state Senate investigated the potential of widespread fraud in the 2020 election, and they found there was none.
This document undercuts the efforts of some officials within the Michigan Republican Party, some activists within the Michigan Republican Party, who actively sought to overturn the results of the election.
And we'll talk about the increase in elderly Michiganders and the dearth of prepared caregivers.
We have to manage our expectations on what our loved one will do and provide routines, but know that that will change.
And a conversation about redevelopment efforts in East Lansing.
If we're only relying on the traffic that's created by the student population, for instance, then we're sort of missing out on, you know, a big segment of our economic potential.
Those stories and more coming up. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Laura Weber Davis, in for April Baer. Later on the show, we'll dive into the stressed systems and families taking care of elderly residents in Michigan.
Given the demographic projections over the coming 10, 20, even 30 years, the math just is not in the favor of having good care in the home of people who want to stay in their home.
That's later on the show. But first, state Senate Republicans released a report today after months of investigation and testimony regarding whether there was widespread fraud during the 2020 presidential election. The report concluded that there was no widespread fraud, and it went farther in a suggestion that the state's attorney general investigate individuals or groups that pushed a conspiracy theory about fraud in Antrim County for their own gain. Here to fill us in on more of the details is Michigan Radio's Zoe Clark and Craig Mauger of the Detroit News. Hey, guys.
Hey, Laura.
Hey.
Zoe, what else did this report say that was of significance?
Yeah, I mean, so as you know, you said, this has been a report months and months and months in the making, 55 pages, although the actual report, if you want to dig into it, is about 35 pages. And I will just read a paragraph that I think is just sort of indicative of what it comes down to, which is, and I quote, "Our clear finding is that citizens should be confident the results represent the true results of the ballots cast by the people of Michigan. The committee strongly recommends citizens use a critical eye and ear toward those who have pushed demonstrably false theories for their own personal gain."
Hmm. Well, Democrats have argued all along that the investigation was unnecessary, as officials at the state and federal level have already concluded that the elections were fair and well done. Meanwhile, Republicans have argued that the investigation was still necessary because so many people, namely ardent Trump supporters, were untrusting of the results and they deserved to know the truth. So was that latter argument made in good faith, Craig?
You know, that's a great question that I don't know if we can resolve at this moment right now. I mean, I think where the Senate Oversight Committee arrived is a very striking place. I mean, essentially, the report that they put out today undercuts the efforts of the former Republican President Donald Trump, who has alleged that there was widespread fraud. And also, at the same time, and maybe even more newsworthy in the state of Michigan, this document undercuts the efforts of some officials within the Michigan Republican Party, some activists within the Michigan Republican Party, who actively sought to overturn the results of the election. So, I mean, there is going to be a debate, and this debate will probably go on for a while over whether this inquiry was necessary. But where the lawmakers ended up today is something that you, if you're someone who wants to see an honest examination of the election and wants to see people put aside their party labels to talk about the findings that they have, I mean, from my perspective and the research that I've done, that's where these lawmakers ended up for the most part today.
Zoe, Senator Ed McBroom led the committee overseeing this investigation and has shown real disdain for those who would attack the clerk in Antrim County who performed a human error that she quickly corrected, but that nonetheless turned into this conspiracy on a national stage that votes were being switched, right, in the vote tabulating machines. Did Senator McBroom's frustration with these conspiracy theorists come through in the report to you?
Oh, yes. Antrim County, I think if I did my math correctly, was mentioned 39 times in this report. I will read again directly from it. Quote, the strongest conclusion comes in regard to Antrim County. All compelling theories that sprang forth from the rumors surrounding Antrim County are diminished so significantly as for it to be a complete waste of time to consider them further. Unquote. Not just that, but then Senator McBroom sort of doubled down on the report and said that he actually recommends, this committee recommends, that he thinks the Attorney General, a Democrat, Dana Nessel, should consider investigating those folks who have been offering these false claims and misinformation about Antrim County.
Craig, what has been the reaction to this report from Democrats and other Republicans alike?
You know, the reaction is just incredibly mixed. I mean, I think a lot of Democrats are congratulating the Republicans behind this report on the findings, where they state that some of these election claims are not true, where they say there was no significant fraud in the election. Things get more divisive when you get to portions of the report, and these are sprinkled throughout the document, where the Republican lawmakers, you know, essentially argue for elements of their election overhaul plan that they've been advancing in the legislature, you know, looking to do things about absentee ballots, looking to do things about poll challengers in election precincts. And, you know, those topics are going to be more heavily contested. Those are topics that Democrats don't agree with the policies the Republicans are advancing. So there's a split there. And then there's, you know, that split within the Republican Party that's been going on for months, where there's a certain segment of the party that does not believe that the election results are accurate. And it doesn't seem that there is any level of information at this point that's going to convince them otherwise. And some of those individuals are still kind of throwing stones at Ed McBroom and other members of the Michigan Senate.
Well, so Zoe, what does this put to bed, if anything, at the state capitol?
Yeah, I mean, to Craig's point, you know, I don't know that it puts to bed much, because it seems to me that those folks that just desperately want to believe, right, that this election was stolen, are going to continue to believe that. I mean, this was, as we note, this committee, three Republicans, one Democrat. It is a Republican-led committee that did this. But, you know, as we've talked about many times here on Stateside, the Republican Party, in many ways, is two parties right now. And for many months, I think Ed McBroom in particular has sort of had to keep a foot in both of them. And that hasn't been easy. I mean, you can check out his Facebook page and some of the comments, you know, calling him a rhino, which I think most would agree is just
not
is
true.
Not the case with Ed McBroom. So what does it put to bed? I don't know much, but I think what it does do is helps the Republicans who want to move forward kind of pivot and say, you know, okay, there was an election fraud. And yet, as Craig also said, you know, there are in bold type in this report all of these different recommendations. And you're already seeing Republicans as early as today using some of those recommendations as sort of the impetus to continue voting on this election package of some 39 bills, some of which the Senate has already passed.
Craig, I want to turn to another story that you covered along these lines. You know, the circus of a hand recount in Maricopa County, Arizona, still has the potential to find a new town to set up tent here in Michigan. Some leaders in Sheboygan County want something similar to happen in their own backyard. Can you explain the situation up there?
Yeah. So yesterday in northern Michigan in Sheboygan County, the county commissioners there, it's a completely Republican panel, voted 4-3. There you go. Back to what Zoe was talking about with the split in the Republican Party. This close vote, 4-3, the county voted to request that Secretary of State Jocelyn Benson's office allow them to pursue an audit of their election results. In this county, the President Trump won with 64% of the vote in November of 2020. It's unclear how Secretary of State Benson is going to handle this request, but this push for some type of continued audit is still going strong here in Michigan.
What are they hoping to, have they articulated what they're hoping to find by doing an audit, considering that the Republican candidates in 2020, including Donald Trump, won by large majorities there?
Yeah, one of the things that they're looking to explore is whether there was some type of unauthorized computer that accessed their voting equipment that manipulated the results. And, you know, that's what they're looking to find. There is no proof that that has happened in Michigan. Even the Senate Republican report today, you know, says that these various hacking claims have nothing to them. But that's one of the details they want to look into.
What would have to take place to get a hand recount in motion for Sheboygan? Would the election official at the state level, or then beyond that, Jocelyn Benson, have to just okay it?
Essentially, where it stands is that the county commissioners are asking the Michigan Bureau of Elections for permission to pursue this recount, and also kind of an examination of the voting equipment and machines that the county has used. The Secretary of State's office has told the county previously that the Board of Commissioners cannot require the clerk's offices to hand over these election records and election equipment. So the way the county commissioners want to go about this is asking for permission to get access to all of these records and equipment. And we'll see what Benson says.
Has the clerk in Sheboygan County made their opinion known?
That is a great, great point. The clerk in Sheboygan County has been incredibly quiet on this. From my understanding, one of my colleagues was at the meeting yesterday in Sheboygan County. The clerk said nothing about this during the meeting. She was present at the meeting, but she said very little about her thoughts on this. So it remains kind of a, you know, we can all maybe fill in the gaps, but it remains a mystery of what her statements would be on this.
You know, it's so funny. After a presidential election, we usually roll our eyes that the next one has already begun, but it kind of seems like this one's never ending.
Oh, my God. It's true.
It's 8 months later, and it's still the major topic of the week in Lansing. And, you know, it probably will be a topic in Republican primaries in next year's election. So there's going to be a significant bleed into next year here.
And here I was just looking forward to the summer. Thanks, Craig.
You're welcome.
Craig Mauger is a reporter with Detroit News, and Zoe Clark is with Michigan Radio. Thank you both.
Thanks, Laura.
With students gone for the summer, it gives a college town a chance to breathe in some ways. It's an opportunity for residents and city planners to think about the community identity outside of the goings-on of an institution. In recent years, East Lansing has made something of a breakthrough in its redevelopment efforts beyond Michigan State University. The downtown area adjacent to campus is building up, offering new restaurants, storefronts, apartments, and a new large hotel, The Graduate, paying homage to the university throughout. Joining us today is the city's Director of Planning, Building, and Development, Thomas Fehrenbach. Tom, welcome to Stateside.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
So there still are these summer classes, of course, at Michigan State, as there is with any large university. But how is East Lansing different in the summer for year-round residents?
Sure. So I think, you know, clearly we have a lot of students that that do go back to, you know, their permanent homes or their parents' homes over the course of the summer. So it tends to slow down quite a bit and tends to give sort of the people who live here year round the opportunity to see some of the places around the city and campus with not so many people, I guess, around.
As a planner, do you have to think about those sort of dual seasons and how space is used within the city?
Absolutely. I think that, you know, what we're really trying to do is think about all of the public spaces and how to activate them year round. You know, when we think about our downtown economy, for instance, if we're only relying on the traffic that's created by the student population, for instance, then we're sort of missing out on, you know, a big segment of our economic potential. So to the extent that, you know, we can provide incentives and reasons for people to continue to visit us all year round, I think that's just only a positive thing for us.
How does this city balance the needs of permanent residents with the needs of students and the university?
That's a great question. I think that the way that I look at it, we're really one community, right? And obviously the university will be a catalyst and an attractor of talented people from all over the world. I think in terms of balancing the forces, it's really about creating a place that is welcoming for people of all walks of life and creating opportunities for people to kind of have experience one another in a community and kind of learn that, you know, we are all in this together. So to the extent that, you know, we can create those spaces, for instance, in our downtown or through programming at the library or through our parks and recreation opportunities, I think that making it welcoming for all is really one of our main thrusts.
You know, there's this interesting relationship that must exist in a community that relies on the economic activity coming from a university. And I think about it a lot, not only as a resident of Ann Arbor, but also as an employee of University of Michigan. So on one hand, a university is able to move freely as its own independent government. On the other hand, it also is not beholden to a city and its own desires. And I wonder, has Michigan State been a good, you know, so-called corporate neighbor in working with the city for its own redevelopment efforts?
So I think we have a really good relationship with Michigan State. From my perspective, we are the two entities that are here that are permanent. And so we have to work together. And I think the pandemic has really showed us kind of a new layer on that in terms of kind of off campus and the strength of the relationship that we really need to have in terms of supporting positive behaviors. You know, and I think that that's a foundation that we are hoping to build on and even strengthen further. When it comes to redevelopment, that's an interesting question. In the past 10 years or so, through the efforts of the university, the city, the Michigan State University Foundation, the Lansing Economic Area Partnership, and others, you know, there's been a renewed focus on figuring out how to take some of the research that's been being developed at the university and really bringing it across Grand River Avenue and into the authentic city, and providing opportunities for entrepreneurs to find a pathway here. So we have some pretty great successes, I think, there to build on, and certainly the university making an investment across the street and bringing the foundation, Spartan Innovations, the Red Cedar Venture capital piece of the puzzle into the city of East Lansing is a big step forward and one that we hope we can build on.
Well, historically, East Lansing has had a tough time getting big redevelopment projects off the ground, and there would be certain buildings that would just sort of sit vacant or boarded up along that drag. But that has not been the case in recent years. How has the city's approach to redevelopment changed, especially in that corridor?
Well, I think, you know, in the city of East Lansing, we've had a long conversation as a community about where density makes sense. And I think kind of prior to my arrival here, those conversations really were culminating into a master planning effort that really sort of galvanized the thinking, I think, in our community that at least some density makes sense adjacent to the university. And so when that conversation really culminated into the master planning effort, I think that was one of the keys that brought developers to submit some plans and work with the city on some pretty complex public-private partnerships that have come to fruition. And so we're just seeing kind of the transformation and we're at the beginning, I think, of the transformation in terms of that density. We've added somewhere in the tune of about $400 million of investment into our downtown, really driven mainly from apartment density. But with it, we've also been able to bring, you know, a significant amount of new retail and amenity space. as well as some pretty significant parking addition to our downtown as well, and kind of paved the way, I think, for the next stage of our kind of maturation in downtown, which has to do with, you know, significant office presence. Companies that decide to make an investment here know how to attract the kind of talented people that emanate from Michigan State University and provide opportunities for them to really work in our downtown, hopefully live in our downtown, and certainly hopefully decide to create some demand for amenities and products and services in our downtown as well.
I see, getting students and graduates to stay.
That's right.
Right. If you're just joining us, I'm speaking with Tom Fehrenbach. He's the director of planning at the City of East Lansing. So, Tom, as a student at Michigan State, I felt wholly disconnected from whatever Lansing had to offer. And as a professional working in Lansing, I felt wholly disconnected from, strangely enough, my alma mater and the college town that housed it. Why has that disconnect between East Lansing and Lansing been the case over the years?
Well, that's really a tough question. I think probably from my perspective, the fact that the university has its mandate to educate people, and the state government is really focused on the affairs of the state, there might not be as many kind of shared interests as one might intuitively expect. And I think that, you know, from sitting in the city of East Lansing's perspective, you know, we're really just part of the greater Lansing region. And so we are certainly trying to work together with other municipalities as a region in many different ways to improve ultimately the quality of life for all of the people here and the opportunities that exist for folks here.
You know, there's this corridor that has struggled in and of itself to find a single economic voice among these two disparate economies, right? Michigan Avenue bridges downtown East Lansing and downtown Lansing over a few miles. And I think there have been development efforts in pockets along that corridor. But, you know, it always seemed to me like there was an opportunity that maybe was going missed to work the two cities to be working together to build up that corridor to push people back and forth, and maybe the free flow of economic activity. Has there been some discussion in recent years?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, I think first of all, there has been a tremendous amount of redevelopment along the corridor just in the past few years now. So I think that's a good signal of what's ahead. And I think it's really built on the foundation of many conversations and efforts that have come before it. Most recently, really the municipalities of Meridian Township, East Lansing, and Lansing have come together under the masthead of the Shaping the Avenue organizing principle, which is really to try to create a cohesive connection across the entire really regional corridor. And that has manifested in, I think, some really great conversations about how to, you know, create a form-based design strategy of how to really, really shape the avenue, if you will, and create that connectivity and flow. And certainly there's been some really positive efforts as well in terms of, you know, some art projects and some pilot projects that have happened. I think certainly, you know, over the course of the last year or so, with the COVID situation, some of our efforts have needed to focus in other areas, but I think there's certainly interest in restarting those conversations, especially because there has been significant amount of redevelopment that's still occurring along the corridor. And I think that creates that sort of excitement and the chance for people to really think from a visionary perspective.
What is the long-term vision for that corridor? Is it something like, you know, the Miracle Mile Michigan Avenue in Chicago? Is it a walkable stretch where anytime you drop your, you know, if you park any length of that corridor, then you're going to find something interesting and unique? Is it something that is looking to build up maybe fewer storefronts and more startups or more tech? What is that long-term vision for that stretch?
Well, I think generally it's about, you know, in terms of the uses, having the flexibility for all those types of uses to occur. And in terms of the built environment, really having it be pedestrian oriented. So, you know, nice sidewalks, pedestrian amenities, nice lighting, you know, things that catch the eye, that slow down the car, and really provide that sort of sense of place that, you know, people might meander a little longer, or they might, you know, get out of work and, you know, just decide to kind of explore. Or it might bring you down a little bit farther down and into the connected, you know, city to the east or west. So I think all of those things are the vision, and certainly the challenge is in the, you know, the funding mechanisms and the sort of design work that would need to go into that. So
right. And I think also there's the potential of cross purposes. You know, how does a smaller city that in some ways has more economic vitality, really, in East Lansing, also spend its time, energy, and resources considering how to build up the neighboring city that could bring up its own economic standing if people were drawn maybe to East Lansing, knowing that a vital, strong, big city was just a couple miles down the street?
Sure. I mean, I think we try to think of it as a rising tide, right? I mean, if you look at the greater Lansing area from another part of the country, and I certainly have lived in other parts of the country, right? We're really viewed as a regional economy. And so to the extent that we are working together, we are stronger together, which is actually the slogan of our, you know, Lansing Economic Area Partnership Economic Development Organization. And I think we truly believe that. And we do strive to work together collaboratively. But, you know, obviously we also have to operate within the confines of our city budget and within the confines of our city border in other respects. So trying to balance those two aspects is really our goal. But I think we have built some really strong connections with Lansing, with others in the region, the county governments. And I think there's a lot of things we can be proud of in terms of what's been produced through those relationships for the region.
So, Tom, when we talk about big, hairy ideas or big, hairy goals, what is your big desire for the development of East Lansing maybe 10 or 20 years from now?
I think that most of it would be centered around this idea of creating more opportunities for the people that are creating things at the university or bringing, you know, incredible talent to the university to build on that talent locally. So it could manifest in a lot of different ways. I think one that you know, we're specifically aligned with is, you know, folks that are going to want to work here locally, creating those spaces within our city, certainly the downtown, but there's also, you know, other areas of our city that are ripe for employment-centered growth. And I think that our city's policies really align the opportunities in a way that makes that very, very much possible. And there is so much just amazing research that's being spun out that has the potential to, you know, really create technologies or create new products. And I think that, you know, to the extent that some of that could be produced here locally or created here locally to really provide those opportunities just makes a lot of sense, because we're such a great place in the world and really such a cool place to be, to, you know, at kind of wherever stage in life you are. So I think most of it centers around that. And then also this idea of using the city of East Lansing, using the surrounding cities as a way to, you know, extend the education that's happening at the university into kind of what I think of as, you know, the authentic city, the real world, in a way that, you know, has a mutual benefit both for the education of students, but also for the community and sort of growing those connections.
So are you talking about essentially using the university as an incubator for innovation and entrepreneurship to benefit the city?
Absolutely. And vice versa.
Yeah. Tom Fehrenbach is the director of the Department of Planning, Building, and Development at the City of East Lansing. Tom, thanks so much.
Absolutely. My pleasure. Thank you.
This is Stateside. I'm Laura Weber-Davis, in for April Baer. Michigan is getting grayer. And as the state's percentage of people 75 years and older grows, more people in the state will need help with challenging medical issues like dementia or limited mobility. The problem is there are far fewer caregivers, family members, and professionals available to help with that transition. And many people who find themselves taking care of elderly family members struggle to find enough financial and emotional support. Here to unpack the intersection of those problems is Ted Roloff's reporter with Bridge Michigan. Hi, Ted.
Good to be with you.
And Dr. Paula Duren. She's founder of Universal Dementia Caregivers, and she became a caregiver herself. Paula, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much. Very glad to be here.
Ted, let's start with your article. You have some pretty surprising numbers in there. You write that the number of Michiganders over the age of 75 is projected to double in the next 10 years. It's somewhat of a story we've been hearing nationally about baby boomers aging into their older years. And at the same time, the number of potential family caregivers is shrinking. Can you talk about what that means when it comes to elder care in the state?
Well, it means we could be in a difficult situation. I mean, right now, things are by no means perfect. But given the demographic projections over the coming 10, 20, even 30 years, the math just is not in the favor of having good care in the home of people who want to stay in their home. Lots more older people in the coming decades, and then fewer people able to take care of them at the same time. So the pool goes from like 7 to 1 available caregivers in 2015. By 2050, that's all the way down to 3 to 1. So the article just kind of addresses what does this mean for right now and what does it look like in the future. People that take care of the elderly in their home, which is typically a spouse or children as that person ages, there's an enormous sacrifice that often goes with it. The average out-of-pocket expense for someone, for a caregiver taking care of an elderly person in their home, is something on the order of $7,000. And on top of that, you've got issues like much higher rates of depression, which is understandable because it can be a really draining thing to do. And at the same time, these individuals, lots of times, are forced to cut hours at work, in some cases quit work. In other cases, they're tapping into their savings or retirement accounts to do this. So that's all folded into this overall picture.
So beyond the impact on family members and individuals, are there also social and economic ramifications for the state more broadly?
Well, I think, sure, it's going to trickle down and have all kinds of rippling effects in the state. There's no question about it. One of the big questions is going to be what sort of funding might be available to address this issue. The system right now is already strained, and given the fact that, I mean, just overall, there's something on the order of 1.4, 1.3 million caregivers in Michigan doing this work right now. So you can see if you're going to try to address this problem in a systemic way, try to find funding to help in some ways, that's a mammoth undertaking. And it's something that you almost have to look at from the federal level, from the state level, from the local level. And, you know, part of the reason this article, I wanted to look at what can be done, what are some bright lights we can shine on this. And that's why I chose to look at what Paula Duren has done, which is, you know, pretty much a by her bootstraps kind of thing, where because of her own personal experience with her own parents, whom she cared for with dementia, she decided to go out and start these boot camps in the Detroit metro area. And these are free all-day sessions for people in similar situations to come in. And she would walk them through, here's what, you know, here's resources. Here's what I suggest for this or that or the other. And even though it's on kind of a micro level, tremendously helpful for the people that she got in touch with.
Dr. Duren, as Ted said, both of your parents had dementia and you became their caregiver. When you started as a caregiver for your parents, did you have any idea about what you were getting yourself into?
You know, that's an interesting question because I understood dementia from an intellectual basis because I had taught, you know, I taught college and I understood dementia, but I did not really understand dementia until I started to walk the journey. It's almost like your heart needs to understand. You're not just your brain, because it's such a huge issue and it has such an impact on your life. So, yes, I understood it, but no, I did not understand it.
It's so interesting when you talk about boot camps. I thought immediately of a breastfeeding boot camp that I took when I became pregnant for the first time and how important it was to learn some of these basics. But even though I felt armed with more information, motherhood alone is something that you can't really be taught until you're experiencing it on the ground. Would you say that there is some equivalency there of taking care of a baby and maybe taking care of an elderly person who has dementia and is also completely reliant on you?
I think there is some overlap. And my guess is when you attended that class, you gained a lot of information, probably some resources, some supports, but also you might have had some people in the room that had children and had gone through issues and concerns. The ability to be in the room with people who are experiencing the same thing, who can actually tell you some of the issues to anticipate, even though our loved ones move through these journeys in different ways, there's a lot of commonality. And so understanding that at some point they may make accusations against you and accuse you of stealing their money. Or there may be a point where they just decide that at some moment they cry all night and there's, you know, you feel like, well, I'm helpless in the process, or you need some help and your family won't assist you. If you can help people to talk through some of that and people share some of their stories on how they addressed it, as well as you provide them with additional supports and knowledge and tools that you've designed, I think that being there, but every day is different with when you're caring for a loved one living with dementia. And the ability to be in support groups. So we not only do the boot camps, we do support groups after the boot camp. So we try to stay together on that journey because we then share our stories and help each other. And then also think about other resources that might be of value.
Dr. Duren, can you talk more about what day-to-day life looks like for a caregiver? Just from your own, it's going to be different for everybody, but in your own experience, what did a typical day look like for you as a caregiver for your parents?
What a wonderful question. There's no such thing as typical. And I think that's probably the starting point of my response. The challenge that many caregivers have is they think that the day will start at 8 o'clock and then the loved one will cooperate and you'll have breakfast ready and the showers at 9 and then lunch is prepared at 12 and it's such and such. And the truth of the matter is some of those things might fit. You need to have a plan, a routine, and a schedule. But it needs to be flexible because you may have a morning where your loved one decides they're not getting up this morning. And what do? They have ruined your plans for the day. So we have to manage our expectations on what and our loved one will do and provide routines, but know that that will change. But in terms of what you do, you prepare meals, you prepare the baths, you get them loved ones dressed, you engage them in activities that can keep them connected as long as possible. You do exercises with them. You then may have to write the checks and pay the bills. You may have to then go to the supermarket. You may at some point you have to clean the house and wash the clothes. It's all of those things in addition to taking them to the doctor. And what happens sometimes in this process is the caregiver gets lost. Because even though, as Ted said at the start of this, many of our caregivers have issues, health issues themselves. But they're not taking care of themselves. They're doing the best they can with their loved one, but they neglect themselves. So a typical day is everything you would do plus some.
Yeah, I'd like to just jump in here and I think to augment what Paul is saying. I think she's perfectly describing what for many caregivers is a relatively routine thing that happens when they're thrust into this role. And to me, it's something, in some cases, almost akin to being thrown in the deep water unexpectedly, and no one taught you how to swim. And so now you're just doing it. I talked to a woman in Kent County who looked after her husband of many years. She said there were times when her husband, because of the Alzheimer's, altered personality, he was yelling at her, "I hate you." And she's thinking to herself, how can I do this when this is, you know, this is a reaction I'm getting. But this is just, a case of what happens to a lot of people where they're isolated and they're so loaded down with the needs in front of them that they don't know that there are some resources that can help if they reach out. And I think that's why it's critically important that that information be made as widely available as possible. What are all the resources? Where can you turn to help? That sort of thing.
If you're just joining us, we're talking about Michigan's elder care crisis going on right now as a building issue in the state of Michigan. We're speaking with Ted Roloff. He's a reporter with Bridge Michigan, and Dr. Paula Duren. She's the founder of Universal Dementia Caregivers. Dr. Duren, I want to talk a little bit more about that, the things that are happening in the brain of the caregiver. Was there a point for you personally where you had to, based on the things that you were doing as a caregiver, the level of humility that has to be instilled in the situation, where you felt more like a caregiver than a daughter?
In responding to that, I think the starting point was I did not think initially that I was a caregiver. And because the research shows us that many caregivers don't necessarily label themselves caregivers.
Right.
And because I'm not labeling myself, it's not like I'm thinking, I'm just doing what I'm supposed to do. I think that the analogy that Ted gave of being thrown into the water and you weren't trained to swim was a good one, because you just start doing stuff. You start doing the things you need to do. You start seeing things in them. It's your natural instinct to want to make sure that they're taken care of properly. Your loved ones are taken care of properly. So at some point you decide and say out loud, and it's really when you do start your transitioning, I really am a caregiver. My parents need me in this role because this is what's happening to them. So your head starts saying, okay, this is real. And then I say this all the time. Once you start realizing it's real, then you need to start planning. But most of us are just doing. We're not planning. And one of the gifts that you get when you start finding out resources or people who understand the journey is they try and help you pull back to see this is a long-term process, and it's not just a set of tasks. And what you need is a care team of people around them. You need to have your family supporting you if you can get them to support you. We need to be looking at, are the legal documents in place so that I can do the things I need to do for them? Because many caregivers are not power of attorney, or they don't have any rights legally to care for their loved one. So one of the things we do is we teach them about those things so that they can then start getting some sense of control versus the situation controlling them. So some of the stuff that's happening in your brain, you go through this moment of saying, oh my gosh, I'm taking care of my parents. I am the parent now. Well, the roles switch. Yet we honor them as our parents because we have to continue to honor them as they transition. Yet I may at some point be making all of the decisions for my parents. Caregiving, you have been selected because not everybody can be a caregiver. You have truly been selected to walk the last journey with your loved ones. It's your gift. And start giving them empowering messages and tools and resources where they can start viewing this as my gift to my parents or my loved ones that I'm supporting. It becomes another, as you said, a brain change for a caregiver, that it's not just a burden. This is my role, and I am going to honor this role, and I'm going to take care of myself in the process.
Ted, what other kind of supports exist for people who have taken on this new role in life, especially once they've realized that they are a caregiver? Are there structures in place that can support on a financial level or some sort of legal level that the state recognizes?
Well, I think one of the fundamental supports is what's known as respite care, which is where either you can have somebody come into your home and relieve the care that you're normally providing so that you can go out and do what you need to do, take a walk, do something fun, whatever it might be, you need a break. Or there's respite care centers where you can take an individual, and this has to be not everyone can do that. People with, you know, certainly with severe form of dementia, probably not a good candidate for that. That's an outlet, and there's funding support for that. Again, a lot of that depends on your financial situation. You might have to pay for it out of pocket. You might get much of it funded through Medicaid. Not that that's not a great thing, but the kind of care that Paul is outlining and what I've described with some of the people that I wrote about, you get, say you get 4 hours a month, and you're pretty much providing 16-hour-a-day care 7 days a week. 4 hours a month isn't going to add up. It's not really going to do a lot. It's helpful, but again, it's not everything. And I wish I could say there's a magic solution to this. It's you know, it's something that I think we all recognize generally at the end of life that people need support, and the family is the most likely place where that support's going to come from. The goal, I think, in what I outlined in these articles is to highlight just in some cases how tall those challenges can be, and to let people know that we need to start looking ahead, because what we're describing and what Paul has described as a situation right now, you know, that's going to exponentially have a greater strain on it within a couple decades just because of the way Michigan is aging.
Well, when we talk about that great strain, what happens with the folks who don't have family members to take care of them?
Well, that's a good question. I think in a case like that, I mean, probably the most likely option is going to be, first off, it's going to be the first level of you know, structured care are paid caregivers. And actually, the first sort of installation of this project that Bridge was a part of was to look at the issues in that regard, because Michigan right now has got a pretty significant shortage of those caregivers. It's very hard work. It's not well paid. People are leaving that kind of work, understandably, to, you know, to go take a job at McDonald's where they can make the same amount of money and it's far less stressful. Similar demographics apply to that group too, that in the future there's going to be fewer paid caregivers available to help in those situations. So, you know, somebody that has absolutely no family and wants to stay in their home, ideally they'd be able to turn to paid caregivers. And then I think the option after that is logically going to be nursing home.
Dr. Duren, I heard you chime in there. I wanted to get your thoughts on the same thing.
I want to just reinforce and offer a couple of other supports. And on that person that does not have any family, I hope they have some money and that they have left some legal documents in place that will tell people how they want to be cared for. Because there's not a whole lot of other options for that person. But there are, like, for example, the area aging agencies that exist around the states. Those are good places to connect with, because the person might need Meals on Wheels, or they might need supports in other ways. Those places can guide you to resources that are available that could support you. But I think respite care is wonderful. Day programs are wonderful. You need to find, like, PACE is a really good program that I really like that offers support. It's just that people, as you said, sometimes we don't know what's out there because we're so busy doing the work that we forget to do the part of the work that could help us most.
Dr. Paula Duren is founder of Universal Dementia Caregivers. She was also a caregiver for her two parents. Dr. Duren, thank you so much for joining the program.
Thank you.
And Ted Roloffs is a reporter with Bridge, Michigan, who's been covering this issue. Ted, thanks so much.
You bet.
And that's Stateside for today. I'm Laura Weber-Davis, in for April Baer. Thanks so much for listening, and we'll be back with you tomorrow.